By the time the police arrived, my hands were already clean. Not metaphorically, literally. I stood at my kitchen sink and watched the water run over my knuckles until the heat turned my skin pink. I kept scrubbing anyway, slow and deliberate, like the act itself could rewrite the last 6 months into something softer. Something survivable. The phone sat on the counter, face up, vibrating every few seconds. His name kept lighting the screen like a flare. Mason. The last message was a single line, sent 3 minutes before the siren started wailing somewhere down the block. I cannot breathe. I didn't answer. I didn't panic. I didn't even blink. Because panic is what people do when they get caught doing something messy. I hadn't done anything messy. I'd done something careful. I'd done something clean enough to pass as fate. Outside, the streetlights made wet halos on the pavement. I pressed my forehead to the window and watched a patrol car slow near his building. Blue light dragged across brick, across parked cars, across the bare branches that looked like veins against the sky. It felt quiet inside me. Not peace, not guilt, just that thin, eerie calm that shows up when the damage has already happened and all that's left is watching it spread. Mason had crossed lines for me. He'd called it love. I'd called it nothing at all. I just stepped aside, and he fell exactly where I knew he would. I met Mason the way I prefer to meet men like him, in public, with witnesses, where kindness looks like character. A friend dragged me to a gallery opening in River North. Too many sharp suits, too much dry champagne, everyone pretending to be bored so nobody could tell who wanted to belong. I wore a black dress that made me look expensive without trying. I learned that trick early. Never look like hunger. Hunger makes people cautious. I'm a black Dominican woman, born in Washington Heights, raised on loud kitchens and louder opinions, the kind of upbringing that teaches a girl how to read faces before she reads books. That night, I read Mason from across the room like an open tab left glowing on a laptop. He stood near a sculpture he didn't understand, holding a drink he barely touched. Clean haircut, clean nails. The kind of man who thinks restraint is morality. His eyes kept scanning the room, not for art, not for beauty, for exits. He looked like someone who'd been burned and decided the safest life was one where nothing ever got close enough to set him on fire again. That kind of man always believes a calm woman is a good woman. I gave him calm. I didn't rush him. I didn't hunt him. I drifted into his orbit like coincidence. When his gaze landed on me, I smiled like I'd just noticed him, like his attention wasn't the whole point. I let my expression soften, then pulled it back, the way a person does when she's deciding whether trust is worth the price. He approached. Of course he did. Nice turnout, he said. I looked past him at the crowd and let a tiny laugh slip out. It's a room full of people begging to be seen while pretending they hate being perceived. His mouth twitched, almost a smile the first crack. I introduced myself as Lena. Short, clean, harmless. The kind of name that fits on a text bubble without looking heavy. He said his name, Mason Hale, and I didn't react to the last name, even though it carried money. I'd learned long ago that wealthy men get addicted to women who don't sound impressed. He asked what I did. I told him the truth, trimmed into something prettier. I worked in brand strategy for a small firm, mostly clients who wanted to reinvent themselves without doing the painful part. He laughed at that, a real laugh, loud enough to make him look younger. I gave him pieces of myself like I was setting down stones across a river. Enough for him to cross. Not enough for him to know what water felt like. A story about my mother, without mentioning the parts that made my chest tight. A joke about dating in the city without naming how bored I'd been. A compliment, small and precise, about the way he listened like he didn't want to interrupt. Men like Mason starve quietly. They sit at emotional tables and pretend they aren't hungry, hoping nobody notices the way they keep glancing at the bread. I fed him in crumbs. When he offered to walk me to my car, I hesitated. Not long, just enough. I glanced at his shoes, then at his face, like I was weighing risk. He straightened a little, proud of being deemed safe. Outside, the air had teeth. The city smelled like cold metal and late-night garbage trucks. His coat brushed my sleeve when we crossed the sidewalk, and I didn't flinch. I let the contact exist like an accident that didn't scare me. He asked for my number. I didn't hand it over like a favor. I typed it into his phone like it was nothing. Then I paused, looked at his screen, and said, "If this turns into a strange situation, I vanish." His eyebrows lifted. Strange situation? Men who move too fast, I said. Men who talk like they own time. He nodded like he respected boundaries. He did not understand that I just placed a hook inside his pride. Over the next week, Mason texted in perfect moderation. He didn't flood my phone. He didn't love bomb. He sent short messages about work, about an article he'd read, about a coffee place he swore I'd like. I waited to reply. Not to play games. Games are obvious. I waited like I had a life that didn't revolve around him. Like attention was something I distributed, not something I begged for. By the second date, I already knew the shape of his loneliness. He'd ended a long relationship 2 years earlier. He didn't say why in detail, just that it changed the way trust worked. He spoke about it the way people speak about accidents, quiet, factual, like emotion would reopen the wound. I didn't press. I didn't offer therapy speak. I just listened. Eyes steady, posture soft. I let silence do what questions couldn't. When he finally reached across the table and brushed my hand with his fingers, barely a test, I let my breath catch just slightly. A small sound. Not theatrical, human. His face shifted, relief and desire mixed into something he probably called hope. That's the moment I chose him. Not because I liked him, because he was the kind of man who would destroy himself if it meant proving he could be loved. The first time Mason invited me into his apartment, I looked around like I was cataloging safety. His place was immaculate in the way men keep things clean when they're afraid chaos might return. No clutter, no loud colors, everything neutral enough to disappear. It didn't feel like a home. It felt like a display model designed to convince someone he had control. I took my shoes off at the door without being asked. I set my bag down neatly. I treated his space like it mattered. He watched me grateful. That night, I didn't sleep with him. Not fully. Not in the way people mean when they say those words. I kept it on the edge. Warmth, closeness, breath against skin, his hands learning permission in slow increments. I gave him the sensation of earning something without delivering the final proof. Desire is powerful. Delayed desire is obedience. In the weeks that followed, I built a version of myself that fit his scars. I showed up after hard days with food from a place he loved. I remembered tiny details and repeated them back later like prayers. I stayed calm when he got quiet. I let him believe his mood couldn't chase me away. Then I started introducing tension, like salt in a sweet drink. I didn't accuse him of anything. I didn't threaten. I did something gentler and more lethal. I withdrew, not dramatically, just enough. A slower reply, a canceled plan with a vague reason. A smile that didn't reach my eyes when he talked about the future. Mason noticed. He didn't ask outright at first. He tried to fix it by being better, by being softer, by being more consistent. He started offering reassurance like a bribe. I like this, he said one night, standing in my doorway with his hands shoved into his coat pockets. This thing, this pace. I leaned against the frame and let my gaze drop to his mouth. Then away, like interest had to be contained. Pace can change, I said. His throat bobbed. Because of me? I didn't answer immediately. I let the silence sharpen. Because of timing, I said finally, and choices. The next day, he brought flowers to my office. Not a wild bouquet. Something restrained, something that matched him. He wanted to prove he could read the room. I accepted them with a small smile and didn't put them on my desk. I left them in the break room where everyone could see. Mason wasn't just dating me now. Mason was performing devotion in public. That's when I started guiding his distance from everyone else. Not by demanding it. Demands create resistance. I framed it as intimacy. His sister called often, an older sister with a sharp voice and sharper instincts. The first time her name popped up while Mason and I were eating dinner, I watched his face. He hesitated before answering. He always did. I asked lightly, "Everything good?" He said yes. Still, his shoulders tightened. After he hung up, he apologized for bringing family noise into our time. I tilted my head. Family noise can be heavy. He sighed. She worries. Worry can look like control, I said, as if I just thought of it. As if it wasn't a tool I kept polished. His jaw clenched, a small flare of irritation, at her, not at me. Later, I offered a story about my own family, a half-truth about an aunt who couldn't let anybody breathe. I made it sound familiar, almost funny. Mason laughed, then got quiet, like recognition had reached inside him and squeezed. From that point on, I didn't need to push. He started silencing his phone more often. He started calling his sister back later, then not at all. His friends faded the same way. One canceled dinner, one missed game night, one unanswered group chat. I didn't demand his time. I made my time feel like oxygen. When Mason chose me over them, he called it loyalty. I called it architecture. The line he crossed wasn't dramatic at first. It started with small, morally flexible choices. A white lie to cover leaving work early. A misrepresented expense. A quiet favor pulled from someone he shouldn't have asked. He worked for a real estate firm, mid-level but trusted. The kind of place where trust is currency and everyone pretends ethics aren't negotiable. Mason had access. Mason had credibility. Mason had a reputation for being careful. I let him believe I admired that. Then I introduced a problem that required his carelessness. A client I claimed was dangerous, someone I said had been pressuring me at work, someone whose name I delivered in a low voice like it was poison. I didn't give details that could be checked. I gave emotion. I gave fear. Mason's eyes went hard when I spoke, protective. I let my voice shake once. I didn't overdo it. I made it look like I hated needing help. Mason offered it anyway. He asked what I needed. I said information, just enough to stay ahead. The request sounded small because I made it small. Not illegal. Not obviously. Just a list, an address, a schedule, something he could justify as harmless if he ever had to say it out loud. Mason got it. He sent it. Afterward, he looked at me like he expected praise. I gave him warmth instead. I wrapped my arms around his neck, pressed my forehead to his, and whispered, "I knew I could trust this." That sentence landed inside him like a medal. From then on, the line moved. Once a person crosses, the mind rearranges itself to make the crossing feel normal. Mason started offering more without being asked, eager to prove he was useful, eager to keep my calm face turned toward him like sunlight. And every time he did, I made it feel earned. Every vulnerable moment I offered was curated, every tear was measured, every touch was timed to follow his compliance, not precede it. He thought he was choosing me. He never saw how I'd placed myself between him and everyone else, like a door that only opened one way. Then the pressure started showing up outside our apartment walls. A coworker made a comment in the office kitchen, something about strange requests and off-hours access. Mason laughed it off. His laugh sounded wrong. His sister sent a text he didn't answer, then another, then a voicemail that made his face turn pale when it played. He didn't tell me what it said. He didn't need to. The dread was in the way his hands shook when he poured coffee. It was in the way he double-checked the lock at night. It was in the way he started looking at me like I was the only stable thing left in his world. That's when I tightened it, not with force, with comfort. I told him everything collapses for a reason. He said, "What reason?" I kissed his cheek slow and said, "The right people stay." He nodded like that was a promise. It wasn't. It was a verdict. The collapse didn't come like an explosion. It came like paperwork, an internal audit, a quiet meeting with HR, a routine compliance review that made Mason's mouth go dry while someone with a neutral expression asked neutral questions. He came to my place afterward and sat on the edge of my couch like it belonged to someone else. His eyes looked bruised. "They asked about access logs," he said. "They asked about files." I moved slowly, like sudden motion might shatter him. I sat beside him, close enough for warmth, not close enough to look desperate. He stared at his hands. "I didn't do anything that bad. I didn't correct him. Correction creates resistance." I needed him to keep believing the story that made him loyal. I said, "Fear makes people exaggerate." He nodded. Then his eyes lifted, searching my face like a desperate man searching for air. "This stays here, right? This stays between." He stopped himself. He swallowed the rest. I let my expression tighten just a fraction, as if the idea of being dragged into his mess offended me. Not anger. Disappointment. Mason's shoulders hunched, shame. Immediate. Deep. "I'm sorry," he said quickly. "I'm not putting anything on. I'm not saying..." "I know," I said, soft again. "I know." He exhaled, relieved. That's what I gave him in the final weeks. Relief that always came with a price. Then the police showed up at his office. Not flashing lights, not a dramatic arrest, just two detectives waiting in the lobby, calm and patient, like they had all day. Mason called me from the stairwell, voice low, shaking. "They want to talk," he said. "They want to talk about what I accessed and why." My heart didn't race, my pulse didn't spike. I asked, "What did they say?" "They said my name came up in an investigation." I leaned my shoulder into the kitchen wall and watched steam rise from my tea. "Investigation into what?" He hesitated. "Fraud. Worse." The word hung there, heavy and dumb, like a bell that wouldn't stop ringing. Mason whispered, I didn't take money. I let silence stretch, then I said, "Fear turns into stories. stories turn into accusations. He breathed out like I'd saved him. That night, he came to my apartment and paced like a trapped animal. He checked his phone every minute, eyes flicking up at my face, like he needed constant confirmation that I was still on his side. I watched him move through my living room like a man rehearsing collapse. "I did it for a reason," he kept saying. I asked, "What reason?" He stopped pacing. His eyes shined. "Because it meant something, because this meant something." I let my gaze soften. I walked closer and rested my hand on his chest, feeling his heart hammering through fabric. "Of course it meant something," I said. "It meant everything." He grabbed my wrist, not hard, just desperate, then "stay." A simple word, ugly in its need. I pulled my hand away slowly, like tenderness could still exist while I withdrew it. "I am here," I said. But the next morning I wasn't. Not fully. I didn't vanish. Vanishing is suspicious. I just became busy. Hard to reach, hard to pin down, hard to hold. Mason called anyway, again and again. He left voicemails that started composed and ended fractured, like his voice was physically breaking under the weight. Meanwhile, the investigation tightened around him like a net. His firm suspended him, pending review. His accounts got flagged for unusual activity, not because he'd spent money, but because fear makes institutions twitchy. Landlords get cautious, banks get cautious, friends get cautious. The world pulls away from men who start looking like liability. Mason, who'd spent his life being careful, suddenly looked dangerous. And because I'd already isolated him, he had nowhere to turn, except me. That's the part that still makes my stomach go strangely quiet when I think about it. Not pride, not pleasure, just that calm recognition of a plan reaching its final shape. The exposure happened because I allowed it. The dangerous client I'd invented wasn't invented at all, just misrepresented. The information Mason provided was used in a way he never saw coming, tied into transactions he never touched, but technically enabled. His name appeared on access logs, his credentials became a bridge, someone else crossed it. When investigators pulled the thread, Mason was the easiest not to blame. He could have fought harder. He could have told the truth, but the truth required naming me. And men like Mason, men who build their lives out of restraint, hate the idea that desire could make them stupid. They hate it more than punishment. So he tried to protect his pride by protecting me. That's when his sister showed up at my building, not at my door, in the lobby near the mailboxes. I'd just come back from buying groceries, small, domestic, normal, when I saw her. She was taller than I expected, sharp eyes, a face that had practiced suspicion for years. She stepped into my path. I didn't ask how she found me. I didn't flinch. I let my expression turn politely blank. "Mason is falling apart," she said. I held the grocery bag tighter. "That sounds like Mason." Her jaw tightened. "He keeps saying the same thing. He keeps saying he chose it." I raised an eyebrow. "Chose what?" She took a breath like she was trying not to spit poison. "Risk, silence, isolation, that woman, that relationship." I smiled, small and controlled. "Relationship takes two." Her eyes narrowed. "He started lying when he met Lena. He started hiding things. He stopped showing up. He stopped answering calls. Then his job exploded. His life exploded." I let my shoulders rise and fall in a slow inhale. "Mason is an adult." She stepped closer. "Mason trusted wrong." I met her gaze and let a colder truth flicker there, just for a second. Not confession, not guilt, just acknowledgement of power. "He trusted," I said. "That part is accurate." She stared at me like she was finally seeing the shape of the damage. Then she reached into her coat and pulled out her phone. "I have recordings," she said, "voicemails, messages, screenshots, everything." I didn't react. She watched my face, hoping to see fear. I gave her boredom. "I sent it all to the detectives," she said. "I sent them the timeline. I sent them the way his behavior changed. I sent them the lies." A tiny pause. "I sent them the name." The air in the lobby felt colder. I nodded once, as if she'd said something mildly interesting. Her voice cracked. "He is not a criminal. He is just weak," I said softly. Her eyes widened, like she hadn't expected the cruelty to be that plain. I tilted my head. "He wanted to be needed more than he wanted to be safe. That hunger cost something." She trembled. "He loved." I adjusted my grip on the grocery bag. "He attached." She looked like she might slap me. Instead, she whispered, "He is going to lose everything." I thought of Mason's face the first night, scanning for exits. I thought of his careful apartment, his careful life. I thought of the way his hands shook when he said my name, like it was prayer. "I know," I said. Upstairs, I put the groceries away neatly. I washed my hands again. I checked my phone. Mason had called 5 times, then 8, then 12. Finally, a text arrived. They know. 2 minutes later, it was real for me. I stared at the words until my eyes started burning. Not because of grief, because of something sharper. Because even then, even there, he still wanted my reality to match his. He still wanted the story to be romantic enough to justify the wreck. The last call came at 2:11 a.m. I answered that one, not because I owed him, because endings deserve witnesses. His voice was hoarse. I cannot do this. I let silence stretch long enough for his breath to hitch. He said my name like it hurt. I pictured his face, the pale shine of sweat, the panic hiding under restraint. I did it for love, he whispered. I swallowed slow. Love did not make that decision. A pause, then a sound, small broken, like his pride finally cracked in half. I ruined everything, he said. I leaned my head back against the wall and let my eyes close. Everything was already fragile. His breath shuddered. Tell me it mattered. I could have lied then. A clean final gift. A soothing sentence to send him into darkness with less pain. But softness is not what I do at the end. Mason, I said, calm as water. It mattered exactly as much as it needed to. He made a sound like he'd been punched. Then his voice went quiet. So that's it. That's it, I said. He hung up. 3 minutes later, the sirens started. And I stood at my sink, washing my hands, watching the water run clear, feeling nothing that resembled mercy. The last time Mason looked at me, through a grainy security still his sister forwarded later, his expression wasn't rage. It was something worse. Recognition, like a man realizing the cliff didn't move. The handrail did, and the final line that kept repeating in my mind, not as guilt, but as a plain brutal fact, was this. I didn't push, I just stepped aside and let him fall.